Stein Online's live Clubland Q&A is just 1 minute away.
This is Mark Stein, back after four sellout voyages for the fifth annual Mark Stein Cruise. If you like the sound of April in Portugal and Spain on the fabulous new ship, the Celebrity Apex, well, you'll be at the apex of celebrity for our traditional week of sun, sea, and civilizational collapse. I'll have special guests from both sides of the Atlantic, including a reunion of all your favourite telly presenters from the glory days of GB News, who've since been sacked. And we'll do all the things you like about the Mark Stein Show and Stein Online, but close up and on water. More details at steinonline.com or marksteincruise.com.
The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now. Here's Mark.
Hey, welcome along. April the 2nd, 2025. So if you're in the mood for the usual unfunny April Fool shtick, you're probably too late. Although we could keep it going till the end of the week, couldn't we? Because these lame-o gags are so terrific. It is 3 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 4 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 4:30 p.m. in fabulous Newfoundland, and beyond the Americas, 8 p.m. in London, where new sentencing guidelines discriminating against white Indigenous Britons and in favour of everyone else have been suspended. 9 p.m. in Bordeaux, where a few hours ago an Afghan, quote, migrant, slit a man's throat outside a McDonald's as nearby children looked on in terror. But don't worry, the French courts will ban any political candidate who wants to do anything about it. 10 p.m. in Kiev and Moscow, 10:30 p.m. in Tehran for all you Newfoundlanders who moved to Iran out of solidarity with the half-hour time zone, midnight 45 in Kathmandu for all you Iranians who moved to Nepal to check out the quarter-hour time zone, 3 a.m. in Singapore and Honkers, I'm sorry about that, 6 a.m. in Sydney and Melbourne, 8 a.m. in Auckland, and an even more civilised hour for the kippers and kedgeree in His Majesty's dominions across the Pacific. Today is the 300th birthday of Casanova. Yes, that Casanova. Don't know whether he's getting as much action at the age of 300 as he did when he was younger. Although they have products for that now, so he probably is. Giacomo Casanova, born April the 2nd, 1725, in the Venetian Republic. Very long-lived, the Venetian Republic. The United States has a way to go to match that one. His name resounds down the centuries as a byword for a male seducer. Mr. Casanova did other things apart from seducing women. He was a lawyer and a violinist, and he travelled all over Europe, but he is known to posterity as history's greatest legover merchant. Do you remember who was the head honcho of the Venetian Republic back then? The Big Doge, as they called him. Nothing to do with Elon Musk, the Big Doge. It was a chap called Sebastiano Mocenigo. Whoop-de-doo. It's not like being the 18th century's most accomplished lover, is it? 300 years old today. Casanova. He was a regular Casanova. Okay, let us get to your questions. Today is what Donald J. Trump calls Liberation Day, and a lot of the so-called right disagreeing with that because they think that America having 3% tariffs and other countries having 20% tariffs is what's called free trade. James Holman says, Mark, apropos of developments in the EU, will G.H.W. Bush be climbing out of his grave in order to get up on his hind legs per Woodhouse in the mating season to yell hurrah in celebration of the success of the New World Order? At the airport now, awaiting a flight to Barcelona to join the Mark Stein cruise. Yeah, we're going to be sailing. It's the fifth annual Mark Stein cruise and our first Iberian cruise. And we're going to be sailing from Barcelona this weekend. At the airport now, says James, awaiting a flight to Barcelona to join the Mark Stein cruise. Will this be the last opportunity to see Europe without the convenience of an armoured personnel carrier? Well, when people say Europe, they generally mean Western Europe, the bits that used to be the right side of the Iron Curtain. And as I said on last year's, was it last year or the year before? I can't remember now. But whatever it was, last year's Mark Stein cruise, the Adriatic cruise, the Iron Curtain. From the Baltic to the Adriatic. It's now the countries that were on the wrong side of the Iron Curtain that have the best shot at preserving what Europe was. I was talking about, we were in Trieste, and I was talking about Slovenia, Croatia, Montenegro, Albania's a bit iffy, but those can, as well as, of course, Hungary and Poland and so forth. It's increasingly difficult. I think you've got to be a real bloody moron not to see what is going on in front of your eyes. In the United Kingdom, for example, what's happened just it was happening before, but it's basically they've gone full on now in which the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom issues an official wishes Muslim citizens of the United Kingdom a happy eyed. There's no such thing as, if you're non-Muslim, there's no such thing as a happy eyed. Tell me what Muslim country, you Pratt Starmer, you would like to be like. Tell me what Muslim country France would like to be like, Austria would like to be like, Germany would like to be like, the Netherlands would like. There's no good answers to that. There are no, to show me a Muslim country that you want to be like, you idiots. I wrote about this at a time when it was still possible to change. Now any change is going to be convulsive and violent. I mentioned a couple of years ago that when I was convalescing in France after my heart attacks, which in my grimmer moments... I wish I'd actually done the trick. But I mentioned that someone had said to me, just as a sort of casual aside over dinner, that, you know, if you wanted now the real... when they used to talk about La France profonde, you know, the profound, the France that would always be France, they meant that, you know, okay, yeah, there's a few problems in a few big cities and les banlieues. And... but there would always be the France profonde. And this guy said to me, right now it's down to, if you're in a town with fewer than 3,000 people, it's still the real France. And once he'd said that to me, and as I was going hither and yon, I think my daughter arrived shortly afterwards, and so we'd be going here and there, I thought, yeah, you know, that's actually pretty true. pretty true. Because you can see if it's above 3,000, not a lot above 3,000, if it's 4,500, 6,000, you can see the future showing up. And that's what I thought whenever it was that he said that to me, that guy. And the last time I sort of tried to do a semi-scientific survey, I would say it's now actually down to 2,000. We are in the very last phase. And so if you're not talking about mass deportations, and I'm interested to see that Nigel Farage has been persuaded to butch up a bit on that front, but he's an unreliable bastard, so I don't know what Nigel's word really means these days. But if you're not talking about, you're going to lose your country. These aren't, you know, this isn't like, you know, losing Chad or Botswana. You're going to be losing two of the permanent five on the UN Security Council. You might want to think about that. You're going to be losing two nuclear powers. You're going to be losing whatever it is. Is it five? Just let me do the arithmetic here. UK, France, Germany, Italy, Canada. Yeah, you're going to be losing five of the G7 to Islam within the next generation. And again, I don't... You know, nobody, oh, what are you talking about? You mean it's going to be 51%? No, it's not going to be 51% Muslim. But your cities are going to be, the key demographics are going to be Muslim. Like your young people are going to be Muslim. You can see this already if you are in France or if you're in Belgium. The number of Muslim officers, well, actually in the UK too, certainly in England, not so much in Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales, but the number of Muslims who are in the security forces. So this whole thing that, oh, we can hold the lid on because we've got all these people in the security forces who are keeping an eye out for, you know, a big Islamic terror plot. Well, you'll be looking to young Muslims to provide your policemen, to provide your soldiery, to provide all your cultural innovation. So all the crap you like watching on TV, all your Strictly Come Dancing and Britain's Got Talent and all the other garbage. It's just going to be chaps dancing on Strictly Come Dancing. They won't have the chickies in it anymore. This is a good... You don't need an APC, James, but if you... I don't know whether you're just coming on the cruise, because that's mostly in international waters. If you want to, it's... As I said, keep that number in mind, towns below 3,000, 2,000, whatever. But if you go to these beautiful medieval villages, you will get a sense, you know, with a 12th century church. So some guys, without all the stuff they've got now, where they can put it up in 20 minutes if it weren't for the zoning permits, but these guys in the 12th century, without any of that, they put up a church. And then a millennium later, Emmanuel Macron and Fred Mertz in Germany and all the rest of them gave it away. Peter says, greetings, Mark. So glad you are back. Given the totalitarian turn in Europe, i.e. invalidating elections in Romania, disqualifying and locking up Le Pen, Germany's attacks on the AfD, political prisons in the UK, etc., etc., do you think it's time for America to stop enabling this behaviour, ditch NATO and end all security guarantees US taxpayers are funding for these 500 million ingrates? Well, you'll have heard the fellow, I think he was Estonian, who first formulated it this way. Why do 500 million Europeans need 350 million Americans to protect them from 130 million Russians who can't beat 30 million Ukrainians? And that's true. But the on the business of NATO, yeah, America shouldn't be in NATO. I was under the impression from the press coverage that that NATO had won the Cold War and NATO should have been wound up then. It's been a waste of time and money for America to be involved with NATO. It doesn't mean you're not part of, you know, the so-called Western alliance. You know, Australia doesn't have to be a member of NATO for John Howard to have been part of the West and to have been supportive of America and whatnot. But the organization itself is a fraud and is, as the NATO secretary, I've said this before, but I've said everything before. I've reached that stage. I've said everything before. That's how bad it is. I'm like a stop sign, approaching sign, approaching sign. That's the pitiful state I've come to. But Lord Carrington, who was Secretary General of NATO, and I was sitting next to him at lunch, and he's very agreeable company, amusing, delightful, all the rest of it. And he turned to me at one point and he drawled in that languid aristocratic drawl, "What is NATO for?" And I say to him, "Well, wait a minute, you were Secretary General, surely you must know." And he said, I could never come up with an answer to that. And he was quite right. The fact is that American taxpayers, it's not just all the crap in Europe, but American taxpayers pay for war gamers to turn up at the Pentagon every morning and go down into the basement, to whatever that room was that Rumsfeld showed me years ago, where they war game tank battles on the East German plain all day long. It's not what war is. The Chinese have come up with a new way of war, which involves stealing all your industrial secrets and then setting up favorable conditions for all the world's industry to move to China and leave you with nothing but crappy service jobs. So you have a nation of baristas. That's great, isn't it? That's the new kind of war. The old kind of war. This is interesting. Well, maybe you're not interested, but you should be interested. And actually, people aren't interested. You know, generally speaking, the right, particularly this whole, "Oh, yes, thank you for your service. Did you know I've put a yellow ribbon on the bumper of my motor car? So I feel that's all the interest I have to take in the revelations in recent days out of the Pentagon, because there's a lot of stuff that I can't keep up with it all. There's a lot of stuff that, you know, Hunter Biden, they knew from the FBI knew from day one it was genuine and they lied. They lied to the public. I'm not interested in lying G-men. I thought they were, according to Sean Hannity, and he's got the lapel pin, they're straight shooting G-men. But these ones aren't. We've just been told they're not straight shooting. They're crooks. The G-men who knew the Hunter Biden. Same thing with the public health guys that RFK Jr. has been going on about. They all knew the truth about COVID and the vaccines. And here's the interesting thing on the war front is that it's not plucky little Ukraine. It's the Pentagon that's been running the Ukraine war. So it goes in the column of another unwon American war, which is nothing the US military. The US military, you know, Russia is rubbish. You know, it's stalled there. It's just willing to grind it out inch by inch by inch as it progresses to where it wants to stop. But the Pentagon spends 40% of the planet's military budget and can't win anything. And so that's got to stop. The wars are going to be different kind of wars. You know, for example, when you outsource your entire... I said this, if we ever go to war with China, and they're doing a lot of saber-rattling around Taiwan at the moment. But, I mean, basically, their trump card is they make all our pills, right? So you're going to be a fighter pilot, but you've got a bit of a headache and you can't get any aspirins, right? Or you can't get a suppository. I mean, you can't go to war if you, Sir John Keegan, my old colleague at the Telegraph, used to say, a country without an army isn't really a country. And most of the Western world falls into that category now, which is shameful. But it's also the case that a country that doesn't make anything isn't really a country. You know, because you can't go to war. If you import all your food, and the plan of the World Economic Forum is to have all the food manufacturing confined to whatever it is, I think it's 5 or 7 global food hubs, right? So if you have no source of food, if you have no ability to produce food, you can't go to war. If you have no ability if all your pills are made elsewhere, you can't go to war. If all your batteries are made elsewhere, you can't go to war. NATO should have been wound up at the end of the Cold War. Michael from Colorado says, Happy Liberation Day, Mark. That's President Trump's decree for Liberation Day. Good to have you back. And as always, very best wishes to you. I'm making the assumption that President Trump has made his Liberation Day comments by the time today's Q&A goes live. Your thoughts and comments on what he had to say will be much appreciated. I'm not sure he has. I saw a sort of general proclamation for Liberation Day, but that's all it is. The thing is, it's very basic. The tariffs business. You can have, like, I love all these conservative guys saying that, you know, part of what it means to be a conservative is to have a principled objection to tariffs. Well, that may be so. But the fact is that most of America's rivals, whether you're talking about the European Union or China, have tariffs, and those tariffs are significantly higher than America's. And then again, you have to look at what it does for the people. But, you know, people keep talking about GDP. Oh, we're increasing GDP, or we're increasing GDP per capita. What does that mean in real terms? Does it mean you opened a factory around the back of the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and so you make those products much cheaper than you would if you'd kept the old factory back in America? So therefore, you've improved the nation's GDP. And because some of those, you know, because those profits come back to you at your American corporate headquarters, because the boardroom hasn't been outsourced to China, that's still in America. So you improve the GDP of the nation. But what does it do for the family living in a dead Crapsville town, where mom and dad can't, you know, afford to? They've got all their equity in their house, and because the town's now dead, the house is worth 40% of what it was, and the daughter is doing the night shift at the Quickie Crap, and the son is a fentanyl dealer, because that's marginally more sociable and interesting than working at the night shift at the Quickie Crap. GDP per capita is not a useful metric for measuring what these decisions do to your people, to the citizenry. If you are a republic, the republic is the people. It's different. In Canada, Canada is the king in law and as a practical reality. The king is Canada, and l'état, c'est moi. Canada is me. But if you have a republic, the republic is supposed to be the people. We the people. And we the people, for we the people, GDP per capita is not a useful metric. It really isn't. And as I said, so basically the country dwindles down to a cheap service economy. So you got all the, because there's a lot, as Elon Musk and the Doge guys can tell you, a lot of the economic activity in government, so-called, is just people being paid to shuffle paper from an office in the eastern part of the country to an office in the western part of the country. And you know that if you have also made the mistake of going into business, I've got to issue you a 1099 or a W-8 or all the rest. In order to perform a simple day's work, there's a government form I have to issue you. So the middle class has dwindled down to those cubicle jobs. And for people who used to work in mills and factories, you can now froth coffee all day long. And so you take an industrial economy and turn it into a cheap service economy. And at that point, it doesn't really matter what your GDP per capita is. It's not really a useful metric. So this is an interesting development. I like the way he uses it, Trump, as he did to persuade whichever Latin American country it was to take back its foreign nationals. You know, America can't just be the gravy train for everybody else. It has to be the gravy train. As I said, it's a republic. So it can't just be the gravy train for China and the gravy train for Mexico. It also has to be the gravy train in some part for Americans too. Leo VT, I met Leo on the Mark Stein cruise, and I said I'd always assumed he was Leo from Vermont. But in fact, they are the initials of the rest of his name. He says, good to hear you again, Mark. Hope you have a great cruise. Leo says, my comment question is about the tariffs and the Canada-US relationship. I am actually disappointed in the vitriol from the Canadian side. What is clear is that all the carve-outs on both sides of the border shows that there was a lot of gameplay in the CUSA. Is it I thought it was MCUSA. That's the thing that replaced NAFTA, the Mexico, Canada, USA thing. Is that right? Finally, my question, can the relationship between the two countries be repaired? Yeah, because it's not an equal relationship. And so at a certain point, reality, one of the problems here is that because after the Second World War, when America emerged as the dominant power, the 1950 moment, we're now coming to the end of, and America hasn't got an imperialist bone in its body, so it didn't do the things that previous great powers had done when they emerged as top dog. So it set up all these institutions, like the UN or NATO, where you have to pretend that the guy contributing 40% of the planet's military budget and the guy contributing 0.00000001% of the planet's military budget are equal. And all the institutions were created. All the institutions were created by America. The foundational point is that all the member states are equal. Which is bad enough, because you have to pretend that the foreign minister of Denmark is the same as the foreign minister of Sudan. I mean, I don't like it at all. But all those institutions now are explicitly anti-American. In the Canadian case, the reality was well formulated by Pierre Trudeau, father of Justin, when he said that Canada's relationship with America is like a mouse in bed with an elephant. When the elephant rolls over, you're going to feel it. And Trump has decided to roll over because there are a lot of things about the relationship that are unfair. I used to write about them in the National Post all the time, a bookstore, if they still have them. I mean, they seem quaint now. But a gay couple tired of the homophobia in America, so they decide they'd like to go to Vancouver and open up a gay bookstore because Canada's so much more gay friendly. Well, it may be gay friendly, but it's not yank friendly. So an American can't own a bookstore in Canada. That's one of a bazillion protectionist steps that Canada, you know all the way about the Canadian content, the points for every single according to whether the performer is Canadian, the writer is Canadian, the arranger is Canadian, the producer is Canadian, I've probably forgotten one. It's a highly protectionist economy. So when America says, well, oh, we'd like to protect our economic sovereignty too, then you suddenly have this whole thing going banana. And again, the reality, the mouse in bed with the elephant. The fact is that if you go to full-scale tariff wars, everyone in Canada will feel it, and no one in America, apart from persons who live in the northern half of certain border states, will feel it. So the idea that Canada can win this is ridiculous. They should be talking about figuring out a way to make it real. I mean, it would be one of the odd aspects of it would be if Trump were to, this whole standoff were to destroy Pierre Poilievre's chance of a majority government, and in fact hand the country to a five-year term to this 1-800 candidate. His wife's family are all members of the English peerage, and he says he owns nothing except for these various American companies operating out of some dodgy building in Bermuda. Here's the bottom line. I've been rambling on this, but here's what it boils down to. Living with the official delusions like, oh, we belong to this multinational group and that multinational group, and we're all equal. We're all equal. So I'm going to be meeting with the Prime Minister of Sudan next week. The pretense of the 1950 institutions has weakened America and enabled America's enemies to snaffle the world out from under them. So you can either get real, as Trump is trying to do, or you can say, oh no, I'm happy to live with the smiley face delusions for another 10 years and then see where you'll be. Suzanne Rennie says, what do you think Pierre Poilievre chances are of winning in the upcoming federal election against Mark Carney? Do you wonder if the low polling results are a reflection of conservative voters not participating in these polls? I've been asked to participate on three occasions and refused each time. Well, let's put it this way. Given the last 10 years, anything other than the Liberal Party of Canada ought to be 20 points ahead by now. It wasn't just the Ramadan socks at the Pride Parade and all the other rubbish, but by every key indicator, Justin Trudeau inflicted huge damage on how Canadians live. And so the fact that Pierre Poilievre is not running away with it, that they're thinking, oh, yes, you know, maybe you're right, Justin Trudeau wasn't really the guy for me. But this new guy, this Mark Carney guy, he seems awfully nice. That's at a certain point, if you want to govern yourselves, you have to pay attention. And And I expect, you know, as I said, I had a go at Pierre Poilievre because just before we devoted a one-hour interview to Christine Anderson, a German MEP, he rebuked three Tory backbenchers, I think it was, who'd met with her. So he's doing the gatekeeper thing. And I just don't think that works anymore. Maybe if he'd butched up on things like that, if he just said, I'm not going to tell backbenchers, they're not in the government, they're not part of the ministry, they're not part of the shadow cabinet, they're not part of the front bench. I don't think it's my business to tell three backbench MPs who they can have lunch with. That's all he had to say. He didn't have to say anything pro Christine Anderson. But you're demonstrating weakness, and weakness, people can smell that. People can smell that. And the difference, and I said this the minute Mr. Harper's ministry was vaporized by Justin first time round, that Harper was an incrementalist. And he recognized the reality that he'd come out on top in the elections, but that in a sense he was a conservative prime minister governing a liberal country. And so he didn't do big things. He did some things that, you know, a small but not unimportant, like restoring the names, the storied names of the three branches of the Canadian military. But that's not a lot. And the incrementalism, if we have a Tory incrementalist for the next 10 years, Canada will be lost. I've said, and I'm absolutely clear on this. People don't get it, but if you said what would happen 20 years ago and you've watched it happen, not just in Europe, but in Canada, where Canada's insane response to the fact that jihadist Muslims want to kill you was to quadruple the size of the Muslim population in Canada between 2001 and 2021. So even if you accept as true that only a teeny-weeny, teensy-tiny proportion of Muslims want to kill you, which is what Malcolm Turnbull says in Australia, he never actually put a number on that. Nobody who ever said, oh, it's just a teeny-tiny, teensy-weensy. They never say whether it's, you know, what do you mean by a tiny percentage? Do you mean 10%? Because that's a lot of people. Do you mean 1%? That's still a lot of people. But either way, if it's just consistent in any large group of Muslims, then if you quadruple the Muslim population of Canada between 2001 and 2021, you've on the law of averages, you've quadrupled the number of people who want to kill you. So we don't have time for Stephen Harper type incrementalism anymore. People have got to man up. If you like, you know, oh yes, I like Canada. Oh, what Canada do you like? You like the Canada? Do you like the multicultural, anything goes, post-national Canada, whatever it was that Justin Trudeau used to say? Or do you actually like your country for what it is? And people have got to start butching up about this. Otherwise, it's going to be left to the choices. And it's not so difficult to see how this might play out. There's going to be a difference between those in, say, France or Germany willing to go into the long Arabian night and see their children and grandchildren in a semi-Islamic society, or there's going to be violence, but there's not a lot of choices between that. Also on the Canadian election, Robert in Ottawa says, Mark, from the Western Standard, Governor Carney lets it slip. Let me be clear, I own nothing. This must be what Klaus Schwab, the 70s British sitcom SKP, running the World Economic Forum actually meant. You will own nothing and you will be happy. But what about those of us who really will own nothing if Governor Carney wins? I don't know what he's talking about. Carney's one of the thing about it is absolutely he's an entirely unknown figure. And as I said, the reason why the election's on the 28th of April is because he's like Kamala. He's not likable. He really isn't a likable person. And it's only because he's this sort of globalist who flits around from one country to another. But he's not. And so now Tony Blair has managed to install him as Canadian Prime Minister. That's still the Canadian people still have to sign off on that. And I doubt, for example, that he'll play in Quebec. Quebecers can be charmed by people speaking badly accented French. But whether they'll buy a guy who's lived everywhere but Canada but can't speak any languages, that's again because he's just been in globalist circles where when you're just meeting in Klaus Schwab's hollowed-out Alp, everything is transacted in English. But if you were genuinely a citoyen du monde, and you'd worked in Germany, and you'd worked in Singapore, and you'd worked in... You wouldn't be you wouldn't have the linguistic problems that... Mark Carney has. But I don't... He's not likable. He's got the Kamala. I mean, we've just seen that. The whole... There have been these disclosures that even from day one, the whole sort of Kamala's brat, I'm with her, all that crap was all astroturf. Nobody liked her. Her staff didn't like her. Obama despised her. You know, Mark Carney is very much, I mean, I was going to call him the Kamala of Canada, except, of course, Kamala's Canadian, too. Mark Lipniacki says, I hope I pronounced that right. Greetings, Mark. Trust you are in good health and spirits. No, but never mind that. You mentioned Millie, the beribboned general, which brought to mind Molly, the beribboned donkey in Orwell's Animal Farm. Apart from the ribbons... Are there any other characteristics those two share? Yeah, if you haven't yet heard my serialization of Animal Farm, I can't remember. I could probably, if I had a moment or two, I could probably remember the voice I did for Molly, the beribboned donkey. But that's available at on our Tales for Our Time homepage. Millie the beribboned general and Molly the beribboned donkey. Yeah, and Molly, once things get tough, Molly the beribboned donkey takes off fairly early in the book. The one thing she and Millie... Now, Millie is an absolutely absurd figure. And I love the way they've taken down his portraits from the Pentagon and thrown them all in the garbage. And the tweets they've been doing... demanding more fitness in the US military, saying it degraded very significantly under the corpulent General Milley. The general wished to avoid anything tough, like Milley just gets other people killed, you know, which is fantastic. And yeah, people were upset a bit about the way it all went south in Afghanistan. So 20 minutes later, when they decided it was time for another war, he decided to let another country's cannon fodder get killed this time. But he's a contemptible, he's a completely contemptible figure. He should, the fact that a guy like that, with medals from shoulder to scrotum, can become chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is something that anyone who takes the American military seriously should be completely ashamed of that. Completely ashamed. But that's what he shares the broad characteristics of Molly the Donkey, because she's a vain, narcissistic, self-indulgent donkey, hence all the ribbons she wears. And he's a vain, narcissistic, self-indulgent general, hence all the ribbons he's wearing. I mean, maybe that's why he's so overweight, because he needs a larger jacket to get more medals on. And like Molly the Donkey, he's taken off. He's left the Pentagon farm to go and clean up in lobbying. I have no idea. Again, this is the big news of the last 2 months. The country's government is a sewer. Everything Elon Musk looks into is a racket. And it's not the racket it's supposed to be. As I said, the first thing he started with was USAID. Oh, USAID. Oh, that's aid for foreigners. Oh, I love foreigners. It's for little African urchins running around barefoot with distended stomachs. Oh, I'm all for giving money for that. Go USAID. And then most of it never leaves the beltway, because it's all Bill Kristol is on the take from America's foreign aid budget. It's all, this is what this is. I used to quote that French book that said, the book about the size of nations, that said if America was as centrally governed as France, it would split up in months. Well, it is as centrally governed as France, in that the wealthiest counties are all the ones surrounding the District of Columbia, not the district itself, where you got all your urban problems. But your Virginia and Maryland counties that will provide whatever it is, 6 of the 10 wealthiest counties in America. Why? For no other reason than they're near to where the racket is. So if you're in suburban Virginia, it's very easy to drive into DC and have a meeting with the USAID guide about how you could use a little bit more of it this year. It's a racket. Elisa Angel says, instead of taking questions, perhaps you could filibuster for 25 hours, saying nothing of note like Cory Booker did yesterday. What was that all about? Sorry, there is a question after all. What was that performance about? Well, I didn't. It was 25 hours. I didn't watch 25 seconds of it. I have no interest in Cory Booker since I sat in a Senate hearing, testified in a Senate hearing, in which he was one of the guys sitting up there. I hate that thing where they have the senators all sitting up high like intergalactic space commissars in Star Wars or whatever. Looking down on you, the witness. But so anyway, I got a crick in my neck looking up at Cory Booker having to be fed everything by his interns. That's why I'm opposed to this proxy voting, because if you have the proxy voting, the senators will be no. Is it just me? I can't remember the last time I saw Dianne Feinstein. Has anyone seen her in the last 5, 10, 25, 37 years? Oh, no, she's just at home resting. But don't worry, with the proxy voting, she'll be in office for another half century. It's rubbish, all this. What it's about is that the Democrats' approval rating has tanked. It's tanked because it's not even as if they're in favour of trannifying your kids, which is, you know, a thing. All the boys will be girls and all the girls will be boys. That's at least a thing, and I can see that you might present it as, you know, oh, we just want people to be who they really are. I could see how you could you could do that, but this is just now defending graft. Oh, I'm going to filibuster because I think $2 billion for that woman with a $100 charity in Georgia, Stacey Abrams, is it? I think it's outrageous that she's not getting her $2 billion. Where did that $2 billion come? Oh, it came from, as I said the other day, people who work in hardware stores, people who are accountants, people who are hairdressers, came up with the $2 billion to give to a crook who's got a charity that's worth $100 and doesn't do anything, but you give her $2 billion. So Cory Booker is there defending, and as I said, it's different. I can understand that trannifying your kids could be passed off as a thing. Oh, yes, Jimmy, little Jimmy doesn't want to be Jimmy anymore. He wants to be Jemima. And Trump's standing in the way of that. That would be a thing, not a thing I'm in favour of, but I can see how you can pass it off as one. But just saying, no, we stand with the crooks. We say it's not enough to give $2 billion to Stacey Abrams to do nothing. She needs to get $20 billion. Let's give her $73 trillion. It's still not enough. Sick, 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 sick. Oh, I've completely forgotten. Well, it's 10 to the hour now. 10 to 4 Eastern time. That's 10 to 9 British summer time. 10 to 10 in Western and Central Europe. And I haven't got to the most important part of the show, because people really love this. Mark Stein swings by to tell you all about his weekend music show.
Hey, this is Mark Stein on The Town this week. Songs across the century, songs around the world. We celebrate a great French entertainer, a not-so-German composer. We explore two versions of the same song idea. And Frank Sinatra remembers April on The Town Saturday at 5 on Serenade Radio.
Yeah, and don't forget that 5 p.m. London time is 6 p.m. in Western Europe, or 12 midday North American Eastern. Mark Stein live around the planet. It is 9 to 4 Eastern time. That's 9 to 9 British summer time. A little behind, a lot ahead, according to where you chance to be on this turbulent earth. Let's get back to your questions. Hart Leonard says, I was both flummoxed and distraught over Trump's enthusiastic Oval Office announcement of the award of the Air Force's new iPhone 47, excuse me, F-47, contract to Boeing. Yeah, that's going to work out. Doing so with two cardboard cutouts of Air Force generals behind him, your comments on losing to goat herds immediately came to mind. I had thought that the idea was to cut costs. Contract award could have been delayed or postponed at minimum with the need reevaluated. It seems there are still embedded elements of deep state Republicans who have influence with the president. I never understood Trump's support of Stephen Colbert lookalike Mike Johnson, who has done little, if anything, to support the president's agenda. Moreover, it's now clear that Republicans John Roberts and Amy Coney Barrett were never the people who were presented to us. Why are both House and Senate leaderships not doing anything to help Trump fight, defeat, circumvent this judicial coup? Or is that a rhetorical question? What happened, Trump 45, is he got into office, he didn't know anybody, and he staffed his office with a lot of the guys from the so-called Republican mainstream, and they basically buffaloed him and got the whole administration off track. So he didn't. He was elected, and this is true in the United States, and it's true in Europe. The big issue is immigration, not just illegal immigration, but legal immigration. People don't like the cultural transformation of their country because it ensures that your final days are going to be total crap, because you won't even have the consolations of culture. Sammy Woodhouse, actually, as you'll know, she's a grooming gang survivor. But it was more or less almost an aside. She said to me, oh, must be almost a decade ago now, the first time I met her. And Sammy and I and a couple of her friends were sitting there in the sort of in this hotel in Rotherham, having a scampi or whatever it was for lunch. And she mentioned that her dad at one point had owned a pub in Rotherham, but because of the growing Islamization of the city, the pub was no longer profitable. So you no longer have even, these changes mean you no longer have even the consolations of culture. Because you can say, oh, I'm not terribly political, I'm not really interested in all of that, I just like country music and, you know, well, you're going to lose all that too. You're going to lose all that too. So the immigration was the big thing. And so they did nothing for the wall, Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, but they pursued the interests. They said, it doesn't matter that it's this Trump guy. We're going to treat him as if he were Jeb or Mitt, and we'll do the Jeb and Mitt things with him. And that was the difference now with Trump 47. He knows he got buffaloed in his first term, and it's not going, and he came in, and it's not going to happen. But he's not a Republican president. And nor, if you haven't noticed, the people around him, Elon Musk, Tulsi Gabbard, RFK Jr., they're not Republicans either. They're iconoclastic figures who do not think as the Republican Congress did. Now, the Republican Congress has apparently gone home in a tiz over this business about voting by proxy. So they've gone back to their districts for a week to dig up the corpse of Strom Thurmond and put him back behind his desk or whatever so he can vote by proxy. They're not there to assist the Trump agenda, so-called, because it's not, it's mainly Democrats who are, and Democrat causes that benefit from all the corruption. But there's a lot of Republicans on the take too. Now, when you talk about this, I didn't like this business about the F-47 thing, because I don't think, I think after what has happened in the last quarter century, and actually you can extend it back, as you know, I do, there's been no victory since VJ Day. It is, and in fact, even the war that was that never turned hot, the Cold War, which was presented to us in the early 90s as a victory for the West and for freedom. And if you look at any college campus in America, it's pretty clear that, in fact, the Marxists basically won the Cold War. And that's important too, because it's not just about destroying the enemies. Talk about this in America alone. The ideological component is vitally important, because it's not just about destroying the enemy's infrastructure. You have to destroy his will. And it's truly pitiful to be spending 40% of the planet's military budget and be unable to accomplish any any strategic interest of your nation. So I mean, I think the whole, I would love, I mean, I'm I'm glad Pete Hegseth is, it's going kind of well for him, but I would have loved to have been put in charge of the Pentagon, because I think the whole, if the wars of the future are not like the stupid way America has waged war in the past quarter century. Right now, China is militarily threatening Taiwan. I think we all know that if we wound up going to war against China, we would lose. I think that's a reasonable thing to say after what Thoroughly Modern Millie has just done in Ukraine. I mean, basically, as I said, that's another defeat on the American side of the ledger, because as we now know, that war was basically being directed from Washington, D.C. All the people on the ground in Ukraine making the decisions that matter were Americans. It's fascinating looking at this. So I don't want America. I don't want to keep seeing America just losing here, there, and everywhere. I want America to have a top-to-toe clean out. In fact, I don't think you can clean out the Pentagon. I think the building should be demolished as a symbol of everything that's wrong with the American way of war. And I think they should rent temporary accommodation in a strip mall on the edge of Cleveland and learn to focus on the things that matter. But we've only got one chance. You know, as I said, this is, for most of the West, this is the last half decade in which it will even be possible to try to reverse all this. And as we've seen, just from judges in Washington and judges in Paris and judges in Bucharest, people don't actually want there to be a chance to reverse this. Scott Scherzer writes from Miami Beach and says, "Dear Mark, Elon Musk and his merry band of incels are doing a bang-up job uncovering all of the corruption that the Washington kleptocrats have been up to for decades. What I find startling is that nobody seems to care. You'd think that this would be front page news in every paper and the lead story on every news network, but all I hear are crickets. It's as if everyone knew that this has been going on and just accepted it as business as usual. Even the Republican Party has been rather mum, as they've no doubt participated in the thievery. I say bring back the Tren de Aragua gangsters and keep those cells in that El Salvador prison open for the elected officials and bureaucrats that have been busy pillaging the national wealth. Looking forward to discussing this and the rest of the world's insanity with fellow club members on the Iberian Peninsula in just a few days. Take good care." Thank you, Scott, and I look forward to seeing you in Barcelona or on the open seas this weekend and next week. I think you're right. What I said about USAID, I think, is the way intelligent, educated people assumed it was going. You think, oh yeah, helping the little starving African boy, that's a good thing. And yes, somewhere at the back of my mind, I know that the Sudanese warlord is skimming off, you know, whatever it is, 10, 20, maybe 30%, and sticking it in his retirement account in Zurich. But I sort of know that, but I still think, you know, it's nice if just a little bit gets through to the starving African boy with the distended belly. And in fact, it's far more basic than that. I was talking about the ability to accomplish strategic goals in the national interest of your country, which America can't do. And the reason for that is because these huge sums of money, And, you know, Americans, because the great complaint about Americans is that all these European, these French guys, these Italians, they're all lazy as hell. You know, the productivity of the American is so much greater than that of the Frenchman who retires at 53 or whatever. Well, yeah, because the American worker has graft on a whole other scale to support. I mean, so there are billions that are being raised all across the United States, and they're all going to this teensy-weensy tiny little District of Columbia and a few surrounding counties, and they never leave it. So they just met the people who... the people who live in those areas live on a scale that in entire states is all but impossible to imagine. Nobody in Maine lives like that. Nobody in New Hampshire lives like that. And once you're on the inside, once you're in on the racket, it's supposed to be forever. That's why you see on the news all these, it's so terrible. I had this job in the National Institutes of Health forever, this program. We'd mandated the vaccine for 6-month-old babies, but then we thought, well, you know, the COVID is so scary, we need to create a new program for 3-month-old babies. And I was working so hard at that. I've been working for the National Institutes of Health for 47 years. I work like a dog. I barely got time to visit my 4 homes. And now it's all over. I've seen this even in, my corner, New Hampshire, was always poor, but it wasn't hollowed out by drugs and death by despair as this crap-ass elite enriched itself at the expense of people who get up in the morning and go to work. I loathe all these people. I don't think there's anything... it's called a uniparty for a reason, because it doesn't do anything that's either really conservative, but it also doesn't do anything that would have been thought of like, say, the 1925, the late British Labour Party of a century ago. There's none of that. There's no pretense that they're doing anything to help the people. They despise the people, unless you belong to these increasingly niche groups. Like the trannies, there's no pretense they're doing anything for the masses. The masses are there for them to loot. And what Elon Musk has shown is that the looting is on a scale. There would be no federal debt. I mean, people keep saying, oh, he's just nickel and diming things. Like, what's it matter? Another $2 billion to Stacey Abrams. Well, it all adds up. And the point is, it doesn't really matter, you know. So you can say however many million Bill Kristol was getting isn't important. But it is, because it's corrupting people of influence, which is how you wind up with the crappy ruling class, that's what it is, that America has at the moment. Israel Pigholt says, Mark, it sure looks like Britain will become an Islamic state. Assuming the UN continues to exist in its present form, what effect do you think Islamic Britain's Security Council veto will have? Whatever, says Israel, who writes from Israel, He says, whatever, we should probably burn it down before that happens. I think that unless huge changes are made in the lifetime of the present UK Parliament and the present German Parliament, and within the lifetime of, and actually with this French Parliament too, and the present Dutch parliament, which is also fairly recent, that it's not going to be possible to turn it around. And I've discussed this in America alone almost 20, as I said, 20 years ago. That's the first time I've said, as I said, 20 years ago today. But I mentioned that there, you know, essentially, you're not going to be able, when Islam is a domestic political issue for whoever happens to be the UN ambassador sitting around the table, that's simply going to be a fact of life. And as I said, there are two of the five UN Security Council permanent members will basically be semi-Islamic in their political dispositions. And they all both also happen to be nuclear powers, which is, again, you know, Macron has just said he's going to extend the French nuclear system to protect the entirety of the European Union. Well, that's all very interesting, but who actually is going to have his finger on those nuclear buttons in 10 years' time? And I, as I say, I don't think this stuff is in the least bit funny, because at the same time, you mentioned Britain in particular. Well, Birmingham, take Birmingham. That's a major English city I happen to know. But it doesn't really matter. You can take bits of rural Ireland, right? And exactly the same thing. The Taoiseach in Dublin on Mothering Sunday, which was Sunday, he didn't wish any of the Christian mothers a happy Mothering Sunday, but he wished observant Muslims a happy, or any, actually not just Muslims, he wished the generality of the Irish population happy-eyed. I don't like this because there's a sort of good cop, bad cop routine that's going on at the moment. So the king hosts an iftar in St. George's Hall at Windsor Castle. That's the good cop. The bad cop is all the guys on the street, day after day after day, raping Sammy Woodhouse's successors as the victims of the Islamic rape gang. So they're doing this good cop, bad cop routine where the king and the prime minister and all the rest function as the good. Oh, here we are. Here I'm going off to pack dates into a box for iftar because I'm the king and I value my Muslim subjects so much, right? You're looking pretty much like the subject of the Muslims yourself, you pillock of a majesty. I don't think this is going to be, I don't think this is going to be pretty, and I incline to the view that some people will revolt. The point I always bring up is the Home Office at the height of the Irish Troubles, who calculated that there were only 100 active members of the IRA, but they had obviously a much broader support group among the nationalist population of Northern Ireland, and they tied down a big chunk of the British security forces. Now you're going to have and at some point as well, then the loyalist side in Ireland, they decide they want a piece of the action too. So they're going out at night and picking off Republican targets and all the rest of it. And there is no doubt that at some point, now the means of control has improved since then, so everyone is far more surveilled these days. But we've seen that, Muslim terrorists can drive a coach and horses through all the surveillance if they want to. And there's no doubt there's going to be some kind of pushback too. And then the point is going to be, can you secure... is it even going to be secure, possible to have secured nuclear weapons in such a country? And as I said earlier, the 1950 moment has come. We've all lived in this long wake of the Second World War victory parade, and that's coming to an end. And people have got to be man enough to accept that. It's coming to an end, and something, and we're moving into what's next. And it would be nice for free people, supposedly, to have some say in what's next. But they're not going to have any say if they continue to permit the ruling class to turn them into Islamic societies. Chris Davis says, Mark, I hope you're feeling iteratively better by the day and are match fit for the Markstein cruise. With Marine Le Pen, the latest darling of the European right, to fall foul of the deep state Eurasia. It's not as good as Eurasia. It's Eurabia. Eurabia. Not Eurasia. Chris says Eurasia edges ever closer. Is resisting assimilation into the caliphate without a shot being fired still realistic? Probably not, Chris. Shots are going to have to be fired. You can't have a situation where one side uses machete, where and as Louise Arbour, before she started doing all the multi-culti stuff on stage with me in Toronto that night, but which she recognized that rape is a weapon of war. It's a weapon of conquest. It's a weapon of subjugation. It's used as such in towns like Rotherham and Rochdale and Oxford and Telford and Banbury and all the others. And you know, as the general population should know by now, what Sammy Woodhouse and Samantha Smith learned the hard way, that all the organs of the state are on the other side. And again, that makes it. And that probably goes all the way up to, it certainly goes up to the Prime Minister, and probably goes all the way up to the King by now. And that means the options for, there's always some people, you know, you don't want, you've got a nice life. You were the managing director of a successful company and you've got a nice manor house in the country with your own moat and everything. You obviously don't want civil war. You've got too much to lose. But the fact is the burdens that are being, you know, what happened to a huge chunk of French voters, including a majority of voters in the part of France where I recovered from my heart attacks. That's very much national rally country, Marine Le Pen country. You know, you're just expected to say, okay, we've taken out your candidate, okay? So don't even think about voting for her. You're going to have to you'll be permitted to vote for one of the permitted candidates. And if people, the longer people go putting up with that, I mean, they should at some point. They need to get into the streets and do something that will shock the people doing it. The judges in France are highly politicized. It's a left wing judiciary. You know, the famous they did some sort of television documentary on the. The judges are unionized in France, and they did some television documentary on the unionized judiciary, and they had a sort of behind the scenes thing in the judges' room, and they accidentally left in a shot where you could see that the wall of the judges' room was covered with all their hate figures, and all their hate figures were not just, you know, Jean-Marie Le Pen, Marine's father, but they had Sarkozy and all these other guys in there. And it's the same thing. The judiciary is overwhelmingly left-wing. I didn't know this because I'd been away from Britain for decades. Is overwhelmingly left-wing now. Where I agree with that guy Betts that within 5 years... it will be. He doesn't think the Irish comparison is very useful because he thinks it's going to be more like a Latin American dirty war on a, you know, so seriously dirty in very vicious and violent ways. Scott says, I'm just dropping this question in. Will there be revolutions to save the West, or is all lost? Well, the courts have just told us that there can't be elections to save the West, which means that a non-electoral option needs to be found. That's all the time. I've gone on too long as usual, and I need to be resting up for the Mark Steyn cruise, which will commence this weekend in Barcelona, and I look forward to seeing you there. It's our fifth cruise. Never thought we'd be doing five cruises. A lot of people, in fact, have been on all five cruises, and I've gotten to know some of you, and I look forward to seeing you all again. And we have a great lineup. We don't have Andrew Lawton, obviously, because he's got an election coming up on April the 28th, and that'd be a very easy, dirty trick to show him sunning himself on the Iberian Peninsula when he's supposed to be stumping around London, Ontario. So he won't be there, but we have friends from my GB News days, such as Dan Wooten. We have friends from my DC trial days, such as Michelle Backman, who came to court day after day after day. And we have, as I mentioned, Samantha Smith and Sammy Woodhouse. So we look forward to seeing all of those, and especially to seeing at least several of you when the ship leaves Barcelona this coming weekend. And I feel sure we're going to have a great time. That'll do it for today. Don't forget our Thursday date with Laura's Links. Laura Rosen-Cohen is going to round up the internet as only she can. And I'll be back here in a couple of hours for our current tale for our time, Just a Frolic, The Girl on the Boat by P.G. Woodhouse, just to get us Casanovas in the mood for any girls on the boat this weekend in Barcelona. Because we had Armageddon last month, so I thought we needed to lighten up a bit and have non-Armageddon, and listeners do seem to be enjoying it, and I've certainly enjoyed reading it. If you're still toying with the pros and cons of joining the Mark Steyn Club, come on in. The water's fine. We certainly hope it is, and I look forward to seeing you this weekend as we depart Barcelona on the 2025 Mark Steyn cruise. Stay safe, stay free.
Mark Steyn's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Steyn Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.